I found my Jack Sparrow part, who looked at the questions I'd been asking up to that point of, am I enough? Do I belong? And he said, we don't have to care.
Friends, it's Morgan, and welcome back to another episode of the Become Good Soil podcast. We love journeying with you through these deep waters as we find ourselves responding to God, being apprenticed to Jesus, and traveling ever deeper in the narrow path to life together. I'm excited to invite you into a joyful and authentic conversation I had recently with a man I love. I've had the privilege of watching Sam become a young man and mature into adulthood. And one of those mysteries in the kingdom of God, in the fellowship of men, in time, as we are all consenting to our initiation, more and more, in our various ages, we move to the place of siblinghood. We become a peer group. Yes, different ages. Yes, different stages. And yet, there is more and more of a heroic brotherhood. Sam today is a husband, a father, and a son. He's courageously engaging his story and his initiation, and he is striking out on his own. Having graduated from his counseling program at Colorado Christian University, he has launched a private counseling practice and a beautiful ongoing workshop series called the Noble Workshops, hosted here in Colorado Springs, that work on the healing and integration of the human soul. Today, I want to invite you into the conversation I've had with Sam, exploring everything he is and everything he's becoming, and noticing how it's flowing from his integration and initiation of the parts of his soul. I think you're going to enjoy this. Let's dive in. This morning I was going, what is my very first memory of Sam Eldridge? First memory is not of you, it's of Blaine screaming.
What the screaming. Heck?
Come on, okay, man. And so I hear screaming, shrill, someone's dying. I'm sitting with your dad at the kitchen table, and he says, I know by the kind of scream what the issue is. Not a big deal. More screaming, more shrills, and then two boys tumbling down the stairs, and you are beating the piss out of Blaine. And this is my first memory. It's so good. And your dad's just observing. You're swinging. Now, Blaine is trying to hold his own, but he's a yiddle-yiddle guy, and you're pretty yiddle yourself. And then all of a sudden, things just sort of stop, and your dad gets up from the kitchen table and comes over and gets down eye to eye. And it was a beautiful moment, Sam, because it was one of the most formative moments in my initiation as a man in moving towards parenting. Mm-hmm. And your dad looked at you and said, Samuel, God made you strong. Do you think that that strength is to protect your brother or to hurt your brother? And you looked it up at him with this look of, oh, gosh, darn it. I had three more punches in me. Like, and it was beautiful. And Blaine had that shit-eating grin that he still has as of today.
Very much so.
That was my first moment. And now I'm fast forwarding to just our conversations, our last three. Now I'm just boom, boom, boom. I'm putting myself in the location of our last three conversations. And you're a man. And you're a beautiful, in one of my favorite grief songs, in a new world with an old soul. So that's Sam. Three kids, one on the way. In the last 2 years, a graduate degree, a rental property, a wrapping up Anson's 10-year anthology quest expedition, and launching into not just the next expression of your vocation, but really a beautiful, thought-through, nuanced, embarking in counseling and workshops. And holy shit. There's just a yacht going on.
Yeah, okay, we're allowed to swear on this podcast. Yes. That's good.
Oh my gosh.
That is good. I love the story because I can picture the first one you started with, the chokecherry, which, you know, is a familiar property to both of us.
Yes. And so your childhood home, and yes. Then I bought it from your family, and it was the childhood home of my kids.
Right. So a lot of history there. I mean, that like stairwell, I can remember launching myself off of it into my dad's arms. I can remember him curled in a ball, kicking a hole through the wall after Brent died. I can remember us lined up almost like in a military barrack on the floor with a cold that knocked us all out, like just recovering there. I can remember tormenting Blaine another time, chasing him up the stairs where he passed out and fell into the Christmas tree.
Come on.
And I was so mad at him, and it turned out because of these valves in his heart needed a patch, and I was destining him for some surgery. So I love that. I love that story because it was like it was an affirmation of strength and a redirection of it, right? Mm. Yeah, it does feel like a lifetime and a day. And I think my orientation on when you say you're a man now, something in me goes, I feel like a third of the way there. You know, like when did 34? When I look around, it feels young, and when I look back, 34 was like ancient, man. You were like, you had left being cool a long time ago.
Yeah, full on like adult world.
I have two minivans, one that works and one that I drive. It's like, here we are. I've arrived. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Fun to be having this conversation at this point because there does feel like a lot that's pivoted, a lot that's shifted.
It's beautiful, Sam, that you said even before we started sort of formally talking. It feels 34. It feels like distinctly there has been a decade that's come to a completion. Something's over.
Yes.
And something is next. And you still have a foot in a world that's over and a world that's next, but you're in transition in such palpable ways, right? With this baby on its way and a graduate degree that's done, but you don't have the diploma in your hand. And what I want to suggest, I'll show my cards. I have come over time, over decades, to a conviction that our initiation into wholeheartedness and maturity as a man is the primary narrative arc. It's the primary interpretive grid, and it's the primary orientation. Those three things. I use those words very specifically for us to locate ourselves in God's story, which is the first and last and forever shall be. In other words, it begins with God. And, you know, Jesus knew where he came from. He knew where he was going. And from that place, he was able to live as a wholehearted man growing in maturity. I want to suggest that it's very helpful and very important to think of our masculine initiation in that way. And I've been really excited with that as sort of prologue to create a pause on this day and ask you some questions to, like, let's go back and let's observe your life from that narrative arc, from that interpretive grid, from that orientation. And I'm just so curious what comes up in your soul on the eve of a very new decade. I'm curious if you sort of see these seasons that were in there that were marked, where you went, okay, from this to this, I felt this way. And this might be a question I was asking, though it was subconscious, I didn't realize it, but this was my life. If I tried to understand how I was living, this was the question. So when you look at all your years, 0 to 34, and you just sort of stay, you know, big picture, like, do you notice seasons, boy into man, that sort of are set apart, and then maybe a primary question that would have defined how you observed yourself?
Yeah, I haven't done this exercise, so I'm really grateful for it. What stirs up immediately as you were prepping me just now was, first, I think a part of me that looked at older men when I was younger,
yeah,
and asked them like how they got where they got, or like, why are you doing what you're doing? And there was this sort of like, their eyes would glaze over a little bit as they would look back through the fog of time, and they'd kind of do this, I don't really know. I just kind of, one thing led to another. And it was such a dissatisfying answer. Yes. I was like, well, how the hell am I supposed to follow that? Like, okay, thanks for the advice, old timer. We'll never talk again. So I found some part of me that was like, oh, am I going to say the same thing right now? And the answer is no, because as I think of the themes in the past, a lot of them, like, they still connect to today in interesting ways. So that's my, like, I've never thought about this. And as you were beginning to ask the question, I went, okay, first season that pops up. I wrote a project with Blaine, my brother. We started writing this 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. We call it the Perspective Project. I think it's a super cool artistic project, but it's a book that has reads left to right, top to bottom one way. And then if you flip it over, it's another book that way. And they kind of, but they're going to be upside down and they'll meet in the middle. And there's a similar cover, but the shot is slightly different. So it's going to be like a picture of a head mount of like an elk on the wall, but that it's going to be from two different angles.
Yes.
We call it our Perspectives Project. And wrote similar stories at similar ages, but like how different they were. Mm. Anyway, it was a fun exercise and it helped me recall my past, because it was like, unless we practice remembering these things, they do just kind of drift away. And the thing that came immediately as like a little boy was, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, not a bone in my body, not a blood vessel was in question, that I was a cowboy and I had arrived to the scene too late. And this ended up in, I think, Wild at Heart or a different book, right? I told my dad once I wanted to bring back the West. And it was this like this season of I'm a cowboy and I'm just waiting for the rest of the world to recognize the truth of that. I remember going to a rodeo and I'm wearing like shorts that are bright red. I can see the picture now because I've used it recently. And these great boots, a fringe vest with the tassels, a white felt hat. I mean, I didn't look like my mom picked out my wardrobe. It looked like I picked out my wardrobe. And I remember sitting in the rodeo looking down and going, like, waiting for the announcer to stop everything and go, hold up, everybody. We found him. He's over here in the stands. Come on down. Like, it was that level of conviction of, like, waiting. Like, when are you guys going to figure out I'm supposed to be riding that Bronco right now? We're like, because I know it. You all just have to realize the truth of it. Yes. Now, I probably would have died. But I still, like, that, I remember as a boy growing up in the house that we did, with the freedom to be a bit wild while also having some containment to that, there was just the ability to embrace who we were, who we wanted to be in like a very mythic sense. Mm-hmm. And at night, this is kind of an odd memory, but like Blaine and I shared bunk beds, and I would kind of like hum to him and tell him, sing him songs and tell him stories from this like world that we had left to come to this one, and like how we would go back and how they were missing us. And it's like, where does a 5-year-old or 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old come up with that stuff? Because it wasn't any of the books I was reading. It was just, we kind of knew, and we were super weird. Also, like, I love that boy now, and I've had to do some work on him in the interim. Because that kind of conviction, that kind of orientation that doesn't line up with the world pretty quickly feels like this giant vulnerability piece. If I had to define themes, I'd begin there with like, there was the young cowboy. Come on, when's the announcer going to figure out I'm here? And then there was the shift to the school days, which really do play up to current, to be honest, like some of those questions. And I think one of the key ones is like, do I belong and am I welcome? Mm. And the answer in the early years was a resounding yes. Like I remember I was friends with most people. I was kind of the class clown. I had a couple different schools in like the early first, second, third grade, and like some sad memories in there. One that I will share that was really defining was I've been dropped off for school. after recess, there's like a elective type thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm in the second grade, so mm-hmm. I'm not like a college student who can go find my elective. So recess ends, and I'm standing in the hallway wondering which hallway do I have to go find to go to acting? And this, in my mind, blonde, curly-haired girl who looked like a ray of sunshine walked over to me and held my hand and said, come with me, as I have tears running down my face because I'm alone and lost. And I follow her. Her elective was crafts, which I had no interest in, but I ended up shifting to crafts that day. I never went to acting in that school because I wanted to be where I was wanted. Oh. And I was willing to, like, I'll be here. She saw me. She saw the pain. I will follow you there. Fast forward to some other grade school moments. We used to play Foursquare, like, all the time. Like, there was no other game, I mean, except for Run Around and Chase and Don't Get Cooties. I don't know if you did this when you played Foursquare, but it was, like, the king spot, the queen spot, the jack, and then, like, we called it the peasant. Yeah. Like, the intro spot that just got shat on the whole time. Like, you were a peasant. Well, my place was the king spot. Like, the other kids just wanted me there. I remember, here's by way of example, my teacher figured out that I had bad eyesight in the third grade, in which part of me was kind of like, mom, dad, like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Like, I had to stand in front of the board to see anything, and you guys didn't figure that out. So I went, got the test, eyes are dilated. I can't really play Foursquare well, but the other kids went easy on me so they could have me in the king spot because that's where Sam's supposed to be.
Wow.
And it was like, I kind of mythic, kind of a resounding yes in those years for do I belong, am mm-hmm, I wanted? Mm-hmm, yes, mm-hmm. 1,000%. Here you are. The answer doesn't stay that way, unfortunately. And you want me to keep rolling it up to present?
Please.
Okay. I think the next defining season to me was like the homeschool years. Mm-hmm. So I was homeschooled through middle school, 5th, 6th, 7th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 6th, 7th, 8th. Mm-hmm. We had this beautiful Spanish teacher you may be familiar with.
Lottie.
Man, she's very distracting.
That was my wife.
And it was me and Blaine and Nick and Jesse sitting around the kitchen table learning astronomy from another woman who was part of the community at the time and Spanish with Sherry. And I remember we had these two-way radios that could reach 2 miles. They were black. And it was Ute Valley Park. It was like, do your school and then go. We have one radio at home. There's no cell phones yet, right? So you have the other radio, go. And we would just vanish off into what now, you know, trail management and all that kind of stuff. Totally. It was like, we just, the whole open space, which are these rugged cliffs and high deserts, sandstone and ravines, there's rattlesnakes in there and mule deer. And it was just like, we mapped it by exploring every square inch of it and built little forts here and there. And it's a fairly big park to loose a 10-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 12-year-old into and say, dinner's at 6. Like, hey, it was amazing. And I remember watching the buses pull up and going, I don't belong anymore. Like, there was a moment where I asked my parents, like, can I go back? Can I go back to school? Because I miss belonging. I miss that. I love the adventure. And in that homeschooling time was really when Wild at Heart blew up. Mm-hmm. And so there was the adventure of trips to Moab and climbing the Grand Teton together. And I remember my Vision Quest year coincided with the year that my dad was really pushing for the marketing for Wild at Heart. Mm. So it was the year he was gone the most in my entire life. It was the year where he's like, hey, you and me, buddy, we're doing this thing. And I was like, great. You back in 2 weeks? Like, yes. Mm. And so a mixed reaction in that of, I appreciated the fact that he did slow it down. And I appreciated like that he was really throwing himself in to try and get this message out there and create his kingdom for himself. But at 12, I didn't give a shit. Right. I was like, where are you? And then we got to do some cool trips. And I think I felt in that time like a little bit of a black hole. Mm. Like there's just not actually enough to fill all of those questions.
Internally, in your soul.
Yeah, and I remember feeling disoriented by that. Like when we were climbing up the Grand, you know, my dad's the expert, right, on masculine initiation. So it's like, you have enough and I'm proud of you. And I'm like, that's huge. Oh my gosh, thank you. Why is it that I'm thinking about Allie the entire way up to base camp and using her as like a carrot of like, if I don't stop, I get to talk to Allie when I get home from this thing. It's like,
Oh, it's priceless.
I think there is, my question was largely answered on a father-son way.
Yes.
And we also have a peer-to-peer communal, and in my case, a boy to a young woman questions that were also floating around. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, thank you very much. Now I'm thinking about these other two categories a ton.
Yes.
And so when I ended up going back to public school for high school, it was horrible. The answer to the question, am I wanted, do I belong, was no. Mm.
Resoundingly. Even once you were back there.
Yeah, because my confidence, that sense of belonging, of being a part of things, of being able to speak the language, had been like paused. And so I came in and I remember we did like our first biology test, and the teacher, a couple weeks later, like after he does the grading, he does this big announcement, like, hey, everybody, one person in here aced the test. And that person, I got a candy bar for, to congratulate Sam Eldridge, stand up. And so I stood up in a room full of people that I'm trying to belong and blend in with and catch this candy bar for taking, like, I aced the test. And then I learned, you stand out like that, and guys call you faggot in the hallway later that day. So when I tested into AP science, I didn't take it.
Wow.
I got the clearance into go and perform, and I chose towards go and belong instead.
Wow.
And those years, I think I've talked about them elsewhere, written about them elsewhere, but would hide in the bathroom during breaks, experienced people name calling and bullying in the hallways. And I was like, we're just like a bunch of rats on a ship, and we're willing to like eat each other alive. And so I was looking for anything that would get me up a handrail. Mm. And so that was dating. It's freshman year, I dated a couple of girls and it just didn't go well. Sophomore year, I dated the homecoming queen for 3 days. And I was stoked because it was like, I got a rung or two or five up.
Yes.
That social pecking
order.
I am on
the railing off the bottom of the ship.
And she broke it up for bullshit because it was like, I just don't want a boyfriend over summer. And so it wasn't my fault. So I didn't go down any rungs.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, I got like some breathing room. Mm. Meanwhile, I had a friend who was a bit of a Bible thumper, debating the biology teacher for whether or not evolution was real. And I looked at him and I was like, fuck you. I will do whatever it takes to get up the ladder. I don't care. Like, you're at the bottom and you don't seem to care. But like, I got to get out of here.
Whatever sheep and goats are down there, they're all mixed because they're on the bottom.
Exactly. Like, that goat's going to take me places, baby, for three whole days. Yeah. And I found myself really baffling. Like, I look at that season, the question was, do I belong? Am I okay? And in the ways that felt like quirky, the answer was no. And in the ways that stood out or excelled, it was like, well, that pulls you away from belonging. And so I was totally like a classical example of the kid who chooses to blend in and pull himself back to not stand out. I actually had one black hoodie. It was black. I wore it every day because it was my camouflage until it freaking backfired, because then kids started calling me out for the fact that I only wore one thing every day to school.
Because you literally used it to hide.
Yes. I'm like, this is the uniform that you guys all clearly use. Like, I was looking for that. And there were some, another interesting piece that I now have, like, with the perspective of time, is I don't know that like my self-assessment was all that good, because it was like, I was willing to do what it took to blend in, and the homecoming queen wanted to date, but I didn't think super highly of myself.
Yeah.
So that math didn't add up. Plus, I've got Jan Eldridge at home, so if I feel like I am not measuring up, for sure that's on me, because he's giving me everything that I should have. Mm. So let's just compound that isolation of, oh, crap. So the girl that I thought was the most beautiful girl in high school, Cassie Blair. Oh, my gosh. I found out a couple years later that she thought I was the most attractive guy in the school when a different friend was dating her and they bumped into each other. And I had no idea that was even an option. I'd like the life that I chose to live to blend in and be okay was so much less than I think I knew was there. And so when I have had to do some work on myself, I feel like younger me was innocent and connected and vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And he got the hatred of high school me. Because high school me was like, what the hell are you doing with me in the hallways? We don't need this kind of vulnerability because this sucks. We will do what it takes to blend in. Mm-hmm. And so then I dated a girl who I was like, I care about you, but I don't, that kind of blew up. That feels like such a footnote to my story at this point. That when time came for college, like I didn't apply to any in-state schools. It was like, get me the hell out of here. And one of our most recent conversations at the summer barbecue,
yes.
I was talking about the Truman Show thing.
Yes.
And that plays out to today. I was on a trip a couple of months ago, and I'm approached by somebody who just come out of the blue is like, hey, I love Wild at Heart. I love your dad. Thank you so much for what you've done. And I actually liked this interaction because this person waited until it was private and didn't like make a big deal about it and wanted to make sure I felt like a human being. And I'm like, well, that's super rare. But usually from 12-year-old Sam, who's not going to school and he's going to these events and he's having 45-year-old men asking what his dad is really like. And I was so snarky at the time, I'd be like, well, compared to my other dad, he's great. And they would get baffled. Like, did Stacey get a divorce before? And I was like, what are you doing asking like this 14-year-old what John Eldridge is really like over and over and over again? And now I have empathy for those guys because
of course,
if I was going to talk to a 14-year-old at an event, I'd be like, hey, what do you make of all this? And, you know, the 14-year-old's heard that question 300 times and goes,
so unfair.
Shove it where the sun don't shine. I don't care. Which is probably like that feeling of isolation and can I fit in again? Can I belong again? So the Truman Show piece was part of why I left Colorado. It's like, I can't go to the grocery store. We couldn't go to Whole Foods, Safeway, church, the gas station. It felt like without it feeling like somebody recognized dad and by extension us. And developmentally, I know now, there's a thing that teens are supposed to grow out of where they think that other people can read their thoughts and are thinking about them. I didn't grow out of it because other people would come up out of nowhere and go, you're Sam Eldridge. And I'd be like, I know, of course I am because like where's the camera? I've thought about, you know, Chesterton's lunatic from Orthodoxy. That was me.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you argue against that?
Say it. Give a little bit of context.
That his uses the picture of like a really small circle, so it's a perfect argument.
Yeah.
How do you argue with a 14-year-old who thinks he lives in a Truman Show? You either tell him, no, that's absolutely not true. Get over yourself. To which the 14-year-old goes, well, that's what you're supposed to say. Of course you'd say that. Or you say, yes, that is true. I'm like, I knew it. And so it's really, really small and really tight, and you can't get free from it. I think now I would go as a therapist and be like, tell me why you think that.
Yes.
I'd look for the off-ramp from the feedback loop. College, I found my Jack Sparrow part, who looked at the questions I'd been asking up to that point of, am I enough? Do I belong? And he said, we don't have to care. And he's great. I like him very much. He helped me for a while. But at that point in my life, Morgan, like, I'm at a Christian college where we're all saying the same words in chapel 3 days a week. But that guy came into my room last night high, asking for eye drops. And that guy was strumming, playing Wonderwall with his shirt off to a crowd of girls. And Hans, you still make my skin crawl. And these guys were coming at me for not joining their porn purity small group that they were starting. And I just felt deeply uncomfortable in that context. Was also diagnosed with depression at that time. So it was binge drinking while taking these SSRIs. And then I realized it's really fun if you just chew them because they hit you really fast and it makes your face go a little bit numb. And then you go drinking. It's like exactly what you're not supposed to do.
Jack Sparrow.
Oh my
god. On depression meds.
Right. And then release into Europe where I was like, you know.
So you're studying in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a semester abroad in Europe my junior year. Again, mostly motivated to get the heck away from the school at that point because it was just, I needed something else. It was that sophomore year before this Europe trip that in tangent with the meds, I went into a school counselor because at that point, like the fledgling seeing people holistically was starting for me. And I was like, I know that, like how my body feels affects how my mind feels. It affects how my spirit feels. I didn't have like the language for that yet, but I knew if I was gonna be taking the meds, I wanted somebody to be processing with. And so I met a counselor for one time. And I talked about kind of the current moment and the weight and how I've been feeling. And at the end, I didn't talk about my family at all. At the end, he goes like, well, I think you actually had a lot of good tools at your disposal from your dad. And I was like, my dad? What do you mean my dad? And he goes like, John Eldridge, Wild at Heart? Yeah, I was actually out at the event back in October. And it was this like, I didn't tell you any of that. And you just dismissed a 19-year-old's emotional experience because you're a fan.
Wow. Oh, this is so sinister. It's as diabolical as what that is.
Totally, right?
I mean, that guy has no idea, just playing in.
Playing in at this point to pretty profound lies of no, you don't belong. And yes, you are part of this show. Nothing's real. Nothing really matters. As an aside, I ended up giving myself the MMPI, which most people don't do because why would you do that? The MMPI is the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which if you want to be in the military, you have to take, and it costs hundreds of dollars. It is 600 plus questions, and it assesses you with great internal validity for all of your mental problems. I score fairly high in the schizophrenic thing because of the I don't know what's real category.
Wow.
I don't know if the person talking to me is talking to me because they want to talk to Sam, or if they're about to spring on me after an hour and a half of conversation. Your dad gave you a bunch of good tools.
So no matter how real it looks, feels, acts, all of that could be part of the ploy of still being in the Truman Show.
Totally.
And therefore, you could be actually 100% isolated, even in a place where it feels like the message is you belong.
At this point, the three boys, myself included, have our survival strategies baked in, right? Like Blaine has learned if I get 110% on everything, I will be okay. I have learned it's better to blend in from the toxicity of other people. You can't beat Blaine, so you might as well blend in and just own that, like, somehow you're kind of the screw up. So I owned this sense of, like, I think a lot of anger and irritation and resentment, and owned the Jack Sparrow black sheep piece. And poor Luke, I think, adopted like just this invisibility withdrawal thing. Like, and he had that for a while. Wow. So eventually, when black sheep and Jack Sparrow isn't working for me, and I remember there's a moment where I'm sitting in the back of this car with this girl who's beautiful, and we were close on the time in Europe, and I have Morgan from 5 or 6 years prior in my head at a Moab trip, sitting there on Wall Street with just those red, smooth stones.
That's where you played me for my first time.
Totally. I still, actually, I got a note from that. And you looked at each of us boys, and you went, "No good decisions are made in the backseat of a car after 11 p.m.
Yes, Samuel. So did you make out with her?
Oh, yeah.
good.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
You got to have that story firsthand.
And
so
I was like,
tell the next guy.
I knew that this is a bad decision. So, all right. But I had this moment. She really knew, like, the dark and Jack Sparrow-y parts of me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't care. I don't want you to know that part of me. I don't want to end up with somebody who like really gets the wounding in the darkness. I want people to know that. But then I want somebody who could look at me and go, no, I want you to be more. I can see who you could be. So that would define like the next chapter for me is interacting with Susie, and the woman who ends up becoming my wife is this like comet streaking across the sky. Like couldn't tie her down.
And you were Jack Sparrow at the time meeting Susie?
Yeah.
She met Jack Sparrow.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Very much so. And I was fairly, I mean, I'm a pretty confident person at this point in that persona.
Yes.
In the, like, I'm a senior RA, and I'm lighting freshmen on fire to take photos of them. I'm having the campus pastor dump multicolored pints of paint on his head just for fun, for photos, because I was also a magazine editor for like the creative page of the newspaper. I call this the popsicle stick. Like once you get through the rest, then there's this like joke on in the stick, and you kind of maybe it's good, maybe it's not so good. Chew it up, throw it out, whatever.
Oh my
gosh. I just like did stuff.
Oh my
gosh, Sam. Which is eventually what I'm doing with Ansons. And less people on fire, which is not very fun. So she got to know that like I just texted her one night and was like, I'm at the beach, come. And it was like, that was, hi, this is Jack Sparrow. Like, I don't care if you do. I don't care if you don't. And it's probably 11 p.m. And so she gets somebody to drive her down. She's a comet. She's not like at my beck and call. Yeah. She's just like, great. I was somewhere. And I'm also in between places. So she shows up and she sits down. She looks at me and she goes, I'm not really into the Enneagram, but I can tell that you're like a 4 and you think you're super artistic and you're highly motivated by shame. And I looked at her and I was like, okay, ouch. You're not allowed to read my mail like that. Like,
well,
tell me why. You're right.
Oh my gosh.
And I think somewhere in there, the strategy shifted for me, and it became like for like the last decade, really. Do more, be better, be ahead to meet baseline, be perfect.
Explain a little more, because it feels like a big leap of Jack Sparrow. Mm-hmm. Called out mm-hmm. a woman that's really substantial that is seeing you.
Yes.
And I hear you saying something in her says, you belong with me.
Yeah.
Like, I see who you truly are. There was a big leap there.
Yeah, there was. I think part of it was afraid of wasting my life away. We dated for a little while, and personally, like people called us fire and gasoline, but instead we actually kind of meld each other out because we were like, I really like you and I like your energy. Mm-hmm. I like that you feel full of life. I like that you feel adventurous. Mm-hmm. I like that you want to be better and do more. And had some early shifts into like killing lions and getting called out for like, hey, don't walk away from you walking away to go reinvent the wheel is not somehow more noble. Mm-hmm. Even though at that point I was like, the one area that has been incredibly validating has been from my parents. The other areas have not been super validating because mm-hmm. it was like, if you succeed academically, you're a loser. If you fail academically, you're a loser. If you don't make out in the back of a car at 11 p.m., you suck. And it, like, just there was just no right choice. And so there was like this building resentment towards the Truman Show that had been dropped mm-hmm. into.
You're saying those were the messages that were coming to you.
Totally.
Gotcha.
Totally. And so getting called out in that season around like our wedding was, it felt like the shift became, okay, who do you want to be in 10 years? And do you want to say yes to some of these opportunities to be the man you could be, even though you haven't really tried those muscles very much? Mm-hmm. I left Santa Barbara while we were engaged and moved down to San Clemente so Susie could do a prerequisite for her master's program. And it was like stopped drinking, ran a bunch, and I think I lost like 30 pounds. Like I don't want to be as skinny as I was mm-hmm. at my wedding, but it felt like this pretty significant like pivot point for me of, I don't know who that other guy is. Time to go find him.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can look back over the last 10 years and go, I have like a journal entry from when I started here at Wild at Heart for the first intensive I attended. And the first question I wrote is, how do I become the man that is John Eldridge? And so my strategy had shifted.
Slow down for a second. What do you mean by that question? What does that even mean?
What does that mean to you listening, to you, Morgan? I think it means, like, for me, it had become the man who's good enough, a man who, like, can clearly hear God and feel confident and offer from his strength. And as his son, it also meant sell one more copy of a book than he ever wrote and be capable of leading your own thing, whatever that ends up looking like. And so there's your bar. Go get it, Tiger. Woof. Never something that was spoken by my mom or my dad to me. It wasn't like, hey, you got to do these things. In fact, when I talked about these things with them later, they were grieved by it. How's that for, like, it was sad, but it also, like, it makes sense that it happened. So kind of a little bit of, oh, I never wanted that for you. Also, I'm your father. I kind of set the bar. I get it. Like, yeah, okay, thanks. So that was, I think, the beginning, Morgan, for me of, like, I mean, I'm 20. Here's, we're going to keep tracing these threads. I'm 20, four now? And I'm dropped onto live TV in Canada and Texas and literally, like, handed a microphone and told, go.
You're saying because even when you started at Wild at Heart, it actually coincided with the launch of Killing Lions, plus kind or minus.
Yeah, I'm blurring a little bit.
So it's sort of like you're thrown into this big deal world that's feeding this pain of a question of how do I become John Eldredge?
Right.
And it's like today.
Right.
It's not over the next decade or four. It's like, well, figure that out by noon.
It's like, go. And Blaine's nipping at your heels because he can actually cite the entire Bible by heart. And you're pretty good at blowing smoke rings, Sam.
And making drinks, buddy.
Yeah.
You can make a hell of a cocktail.
Exactly. And that became like...
Not just smoke rings, Sam.
Yes. So much more. Thank you. And I mean, like, I had these pieces of the erratic creativity that I loved, right? Like the setting the kids on fire, which, we use two pairs of jeans and brake cleaner spray, which is highly flammable. The top layer of jeans went in the trash.
The kids lived
he was
to
fine.
Tell the story.
He was fine. It was one guy. His name was also Sam, and maybe there was something subconscious there.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know. So, it was, like, all these things coincided with, like, ready, set, go, have the right answer. Be a person you've not quite been before and have permission to kind of be them, maybe, sort of. And Morgan, I would define, like, the last 10 years as a chapter, like, if I had to zoom out and speak over it, it would be failing in new protective ways and learning that stuffing the past is not the same thing as dealing with it. And by dealing with it, I mean healing from it or learning to carry it. I have about 1,000 quotes here for you, but we're not going to need most of them. Here's one from a book by Robert Jordan, his like final ones in the series Wheel of Time. It's like 15 books long, and I love getting lost in fantasy. One of the protagonists in the series has got wounded in like the second book and the wound never healed and can't heal. And it defined a lot of his choices and a lot of his pain and a lot of his character. And then here at the end is this, the secret, it turned out, had not been to harden himself to the point of breaking. It had not been to become numb. It had been to walk in pain, like the pain of the wounds at his side, and to accept that pain as part of him.
What does that mean to you?
That was like somebody opening a door I didn't see in the room that I could walk through of, I carry a lot of pain, and I've either been trying to numb it or harden myself from it or perform myself away from it. And that was this putting words to at the end of the chapter of this decade. Like I read that like 2 years ago when I'd done a lot of work already. So I think I had eyes to see it. And it was like, oh, right. Thank you. I actually need to be okay with embracing that there are there are parts of my story that are brutal, and I don't want to dissociate from them, leave them behind, harden myself from them, walk away from them, pretend like they're not there. Whether that's something quote unquote small, like feeling like a schizophrenic because I didn't know what was real or not.
Yes.
Or something big like losing Craig and Patrick and experiencing the hate from the motorcycle community all in one matter of like 6 months. You know, culturally, we are better at dealing with capital T, big trauma. Like, oh, I see that. I have eyes to see what that looks like. We don't understand very much like the toxic waters you swam in of complex trauma, which we're calling lower T trauma, but you guys, it's called complex trauma. They've got to like learn.
For a reason.
Right. And on a scale of trauma, 1 to 5, it's a 4. And 5 is dissociative identity disorder, where you begin to split yourself so you don't have to carry what it what it's been like. So it's, I think more of us are that at a 4 in some categories than we realize.
Sam, I'm really enjoying being with you, and I'm really enjoying this conversation. In some ways, it feels like we're just getting started, and at the same time, it feels like a full portion. And so on behalf of our listeners, these like-hearted allies engaging in their initiation alongside of us, I want to pause, bring closure to this as a first episode. And Sam, I would love to pick up the conversation for a part two on initiating our parts. So friends, by way of closure and transition out of this episode, what I want to invite you to notice is the relationships within you, the relationships between your parts, and maybe as simple as how older you relates to younger you. As you tune in and notice the different feelings that have surfaced as you've listened to Sam's story and as his bravery draws out emotion in you, what's underneath? What's operating within you? And what are the current relationships between the parts within you that Jesus perhaps wants to shine his light? Let's take 90 seconds to invite Christ into that space to shine his light, the lamp into our feet and the light into our path. Savor an opportunity to simply be with God in this place. Thanks for joining Sam and I, and we really look forward to being back together for the next episode of the Initiation of Our Parts with Sam Eldridge.